Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for joining us on the NOLA Drink Show, friends, this time around. Happy to have you here, as always. Got a really fun show coming up for you here right after, this little opening segment, because that's what we do here on the NOLA Drink Show, right? Yeah, you know that. Anyway, great show coming up for you. We're going to be chatting with Roger Anderson, who is the creator and host of the Wonderful Kitchen Counter podcast. Roger's out in the Willamette Valley, Salem, Oregon area. And he does this really great podcast. It's geared towards the home cook, and it's really a lot of fun. Each episode's about a half an hour long, give or take. He has guests on from time to time. He talks about techniques from time to time, specific recipes, brings a little bit of science, but not too much. Brings concepts, ideas, tips, tricks, kind of demystifying things in the kitchen for the home cook. And it's all kind of in a no judgment zone. And I really like his approach. It's just very friendly, very practical, very down to earth, and very informative. I just listened to a few of his episodes recently, some of his latest ones, and they're all terrific. And I came away learning all kinds of stuff. And being an avid home cook myself, just another great tool in the toolbox that you can use in the kitchen if you enjoy cooking at home. I highly recommend it. So we're going to chat with Roger a bit about his show, how he got it started, his background, and all kinds of other good stuff. And he's just a great guy. And his show, the Kitchen Counter Podcast, is one of the newest shows on the Nitty Grits podcasts. That's what we're calling it now. We used to call it the Nitty Grits Podcast Network, but we changed the name to Nitty Grits Podcast. I'm still getting used to that. But of course, you've heard me mention this before. That is the podcast network that's part of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum and the National Food and Beverage Foundation. And you'll find this show, the NOLA Drink Show, on there as well. And we're adding shows all the time. Being very careful, making sure they're good, making sure that we think you'll be interested in them, making sure that they've got staying power, all that good stuff. And Roger's show, the Kitchen Counter Podcast, is one of the newest members of the Nitty Grits Podcasts family. We're very happy to have him on board. Got a good show coming up for you too next week, friends. The plan right now is we are going to be chatting with Tracy Napolitano and Barbara Hirsch Napolitano. They are the founders, the co-founders of the New Orleans Bourbon Festival. And as you may know, I've talked about this before, full disclosure, right? I think we have to do that these days. I am on the board of directors of the charity called Kids Can NOLA that puts on and benefits from the New Orleans Bourbon Festival. And we had a rough go of it in 2020, just like a lot of people did. Unfortunately for us, the festival was supposed to start on Thursday, and the Wednesday before is when New Orleans shut down due to the pandemic. So we had to cancel or postpone, I should say, at the 11th hour. Tough decision. It was just all kind of crazy times like it was for everybody. But right up to the mark. And we had to pull the plug, at least temporarily, on it. Well, I'm pleased to tell you it's going to be back next month in August, in the third week of August. And we're bringing it right back to you. And we're going to chat with Tracy and Barbara. A little bit of a preview. Let you know what to expect at this year's Bourbon Festival. And also probably let you know about 2022, because the idea and the plan, and that's the way it's going to be. It's going to be right back where it's supposed to be in March of next year. Oh, yeah. So we'll hear all about that stuff when we chat with Tracy and Barbara on the next program. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, and then we're going to be back with Roger Anderson from the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Come on back. Hi, Brian Diaz, host of the NOLA Drink Show here. Check out Nitty Grits Podcasts, a growing network of food, drink, and culture shows. Visit southernfood.org for more. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends. As you know, I'm always happy to have you here on the NOLA Drink Show, and always, now I shouldn't say always, because this is the first time, very happy to have my next guest, Roger Anderson from the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Roger, how are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm so happy to be here.
Thank you, Roger. And you know, I teed this up at the beginning of the show, but very excited to have you on because you're a fellow podcaster. We know the show airs on podcast as well as radio. But importantly, you are one of my podcast network mates, as it were, on the Nitty Grits podcast, which is the Southern Food and Beverage Museum's podcast network that we ramped up. And you are one of the newest shows on the network. So I'm really excited to have you as a team member to be on the show here with me.
You know what? I love that. And I'm so excited about it. I think I joined in June of 2021. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of a loner, but I love what you guys are doing with this. I'm so excited to be a part of it, ready to get in and contribute, be a team member. So thanks for having me on the network.
It's definitely our pleasure. We're really great. We're very careful about the shows that we're adding, and we're growing slowly but surely. And I think after the first original three shows, mine, Tip of the Tongue, with Liz Williams, who's the museum founder and my co-executive producer there, the network, and Poppy's show, Louisiana Eats, you were the first one at it. And a great worthy addition. So thank you for sharing your content with us.
It's an honor and a pleasure. So thanks for the kind words.
Absolutely. Well, I want to get into in just a second here, get into what the Kitchen Counter podcast is all about. It's a terrific show. But you're just so we're doing our due diligence here. You're actually out in the Willamette Valley of Oregon, are you not?
I am in Salem, Oregon, right in the heart of the beautiful Willamette Valley. I mean, we've been having a little heat issue here the last few days, but ordinarily I would tell anybody the summertime in the Willamette Valley, there's not a more beautiful place on earth.
Yeah.
And you would like it here. And you probably know we have great wine. We have great beer. I mean, if you like to drink, Oregon's a great place to be, man. Maybe second to New Orleans.
That's very truthful. When it comes to when it comes to wine and beer, it blows here away. We got a good beer scene going on here now. I think we got about 35 breweries in Southeast Louisiana, so that's getting better. Wine and heat and humidity at this level just they don't play nice.
Fair.
But yeah, you are in the land of Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris to be sure. And so are you from there, Roger? Originally, where are you from?
I am from Oregon. I was born in a little town called Toledo, which is right near the coast, near Newport. I mean, I'd say Toledo and people are Toledo, Spain, Toledo, Ohio, Toledo, Washington. No, Toledo, Oregon, about 3,000 people. I've been all over the world traveling for different things, but Oregon is where my heart is.
That's cool. My mom lives in Brookings, by the way.
Okay. So, yeah. Beautiful. Yeah, banana belt of Oregon down there. Yeah. Or not the banana belt. That's probably the wrong term. It's just so nice. Sunshine belt, I guess.
There you go. We'll call it that.
Yeah.
So now the Kitchen Counter podcast, you're up to almost 200 episodes, I think, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Getting there. 188 as of today, I think. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. And so tell us, it's such a cool show, and it's geared towards, I'll let you describe it, of course, but geared towards the home cook. And I really enjoy listening to it lately since you joined the network. I think it's about demystifying things, isn't it? Making things accessible, making things not overwhelming. You can do it too kind of attitude.
Yeah, I think that's a fair description. And, you know, I have a little bit of a scattered personality. So at the very base of it, the show is about home cooking. And so that, you know, some of my listeners like the interviews I do with other folks. Some of the listeners like it when I live cook a recipe and record it for the podcast. Sometimes I just talk about a certain technique or a topic or an ingredient on the show. Just kind of whatever I feel like doing. I know some of my listeners probably wish I would stick with one thing and go with it, but I just love I love home cooking. So whatever is striking my fancy at any particular time, you know, I can just get on and make an episode about it. And you're right. It is about demystifying. It's about helping people. I don't care what they want to cook. I don't care how they want to eat. I don't have an agenda. I'm not pushing a lifestyle. I'm not a diet guru or anything like that. I really don't care about any of that stuff. I have opinions on all that stuff. But, you know, I just want to help them have fun, be more confident, learn new things in the kitchen. That's really what it's all about.
That's great. Now, how did you have a culinary background? I know you say in your bio description on your website, you just, as far as I know, right, you basically just started by being an avid home cook yourself, correct?
Yeah. You know, my mom made home cooked meals every day, and my mom actually has a little bit of a restaurant background. She, in her career, worked in a lot of, quick service, short order, diner type places, owned a few. And so what always struck me about my mom is she would go to work all day at those places and she would come home and still make food for the family. Wow. It blows my mind. I can't even imagine. Wow, I don't do anything strenuous and I can barely get a meal out for the family. Right. But she was a good cook, and all of our, you know, for our family, for my immediate family, food is a big deal. And it, we do a lot of things around food as a family, and it really does help us connect. You know, we all live in our own places and have our own lives. But no, I am not a trained chef. I am not, you know, I worked in some of those places in the food industry, but I just cooked. I picked that up from my mom and a little bit from my dad, and I've just cooked my whole life. And way back when, I thought, I want to do a podcast because I love the medium. What am I going to do a podcast about? And I thought, well, I'm a pretty decent home cook, and I like to think I'm fairly approachable. I mean, how modest does that sound? But, sure. You know, I could do a show about that. And when I started the show, there weren't that many food or really cooking podcasts out there.
Yeah. So did you work directly with your mom at some of her places, or did you kind of?
Sure, but okay. I was pretty little. So I'm okay. Six of six kids.
Okay.
And my oldest brother, who we talked about a little bit ago, I came to New Orleans with a couple of years ago. He's 18 years older than I am. So there's quite a spread. Okay. Between the six kids. So, but you know, I made milkshakes and I washed dishes and I mopped floors and I bused tables. You know, I did all that stuff that you do when you're part of a family business, and you know, you lend your skill set where it works. So I wouldn't say I got necessarily cooking skills at those places, but I certainly, it was another thing that just cemented the importance of food.
Right.
You know, for the family.
Got it. Now, if in that the makes case, sense. Yeah. It really does. In the case of your mom then, because that's got to be, not only did she work all day at a place, then as you mentioned, she came home and cooked for the family, a sizable family, it sounds like. Did you learn a lot from her in the kitchen at home? And did she take a different approach? I mean, obviously you're not doing short order stuff when you're cooking for the family, but did she sort of take a different approach and try and build the culinary background that you come from?
You know, I don't think my mom ever intentionally set out to say, I'm going to teach my kids how to cook. I'm going to imbue whatever cooking values in them. It was more of a necessity, right? Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, there was always a lot of love and a lot of care. And that's true whether she was making something from scratch or whether she was putting something together from a couple of cans in a box, right? And it took me a long time in my life. You know, you get into the foodie scene and you watch food television. You're like, oh, that's how cooking should be. And you kind of get away from that, right? And it takes a long time to come around and go like, it's okay to cook stuff out of a can. It's okay to cook stuff out of a box. It's okay to cook stuff from scratch. You know, coming the long way around, you know, it's weird, but sometimes it's like, I'm okay with that. You know, there was a time in my life I probably didn't like, my mom was a good cook, but she didn't really cook. Like, you know, she wasn't a chef. Well, obviously not. She was a home cook who was cooking for a family. I get that now, right? It just takes some time to, and in years and perspective. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, you mentioned this in actually, I think your latest episode, if I remember right, you had the noted, food journalist Mark Bittman on, and Mark used to write for the New York Times, right, if I remember correctly, and has a podcast and such. And you know, you guys were talking about the idea that so much of the importance of cooking at home is about, you know, delivering nutrition in a timely fashion, and then ideally it tastes good. And I mean, that's really kind of what it boils down to, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's. I mean, a lot of people approach home cooking in different ways. So for some, it's an absolute necessity, and it's a struggle, certainly, to get good, nutritious food for their family. Some, on the other end of the spectrum, it's like a fun hobby. And I, you know, if I don't cook at home, I'll just go out to a restaurant and get some food. I'm not going to starve. And there's a spectrum in between, and there's probably even more fringe, but, you know, that's kind of the spectrum I'm thinking about here. And, you know, at the end of the day, though, I would like to think that I'm helping folks that just need to get good food out for their family or their friends or themselves. We have a lot of people that listen that are single or maybe are just cooking for a couple. Their kids have left home. And, you know, again, I don't have an agenda for what nutrition even means. I just want to help them cook and have fun doing it. I mean, you can have the necessity to cook, but you can also have fun doing it. It's just if you don't get too wrapped up in the image of it all, right?
Yeah.
Taking pictures of your food to put on Instagram, which is cool, but it's like, that's not what real food generally looks like when you go to these flashy blogs, right? Food's amazing. You'll never cook anything that's probably going to look like that, even if you follow the recipe to a T. because they took 50 pictures of that. They've edited it. They've maybe made the dish five times.
The vanilla ice cream is actually mashed potatoes.
Or whatever. Yeah, with motor oil on the pancakes or whatever. But I mean, it's like, I don't know. I'm very passionate and even more passionate lately about this idea that home cooking, I think there's this image of what it is out in the world that just is not really true. It's fun. You know, I like watching Chopped as much as the next guy. I like watching Top Chef as much as anyone else. But I know at the end of the day, that's not really what people are doing in their kitchens at home on a daily basis, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know what? And let me ask you this question, because I was having this conversation the other day, actually at the aforementioned Southern Food and Beverage Museum. And we were talking about the idea, these ad campaigns that we're seeing for people that are selling like meals in a box or pre-prepared meals coming from afar. And I won't name names, but all these ones that are out there. And one of them has an ad campaign where the whole idea is it's a young couple and they sign up for the service and a box shows up and then they have this celebration because we quote unquote never have to cook again. And and I get that, and I think you're driving at this, Roger, that I get that, look, it's a challenge for a lot of people. People are short on time. There's budgetary considerations, all these different things. But what we were talking, you know, because everybody, we're sort of a co-opted audience there at the museum. Everybody cooks and everybody likes to cook. Mm-hmm. And there's there's a joy for me. You were talking about being, you know, sort of a multitasker yourself. And for me, cooking provides such a joy of after a busy day of singular focus, open a bottle of wine, make food, put on some nice music. And that's what I'm just kind of focused on. And I can put a lot of the noise aside. There is great pleasure in that. And where I'm going with this is, do you find that a lot of people, that is, they've got to take that journey to realize there's joy there because they're just daunted by this sort of wall of mystery that stands in front of them to put out, you know, solid food at home?
Yeah, I mean, and people probably get there in different ways. I mean, like I say, you know, some people may have never cooked a thing in their life, but they get caught up in like the foodie ideal, right? And they're watching these shows and they subscribe to all these crazy Instagram channels and they're looking at these pictures. And so they're coming at it right from a completely different angle than somebody who's like, I've got $100 a week, you know, to feed my family of four or whatever, what in the world am I going to do? So, and you can always, both of those people can arrive at the same place at the end of the day. But the point being that I think the people that treat it more as a hobby or a luxury, and again, there's nothing wrong with that. I would put myself in that camp to some degree. I think they have a little more leeway to explore and to look for inspiration, and they can go out to restaurants and eat food and say, like, I'm going to try to make that amazing grilled shrimp at home. You know, that sort of thing. Whereas I don't know if I'm answering your question exactly, but
yeah,
I mean, you know, then you got the folks that are there, and I don't want to make this like dichotomy, like too big of a deal, but, yeah, I'm kind of losing the thread, but I mean, those are just some general thoughts on that.
I think that makes sense. I think a lot of people think, and you did answer the question that people see things out there that are very image driven. I think that's the important part. And there's, I think actually you talked about it on the show with Mark Bittman. You were talking about how everything on TV, it's either a competition or I think he said, you're made to feel inferior. And there's something more or less along those lines, because as you just said, you can't put that kind of stuff out. It's really, no one really does. Even restaurants really don't necessarily when you're seeing what they're putting on Instagram. And I think that I've found a lot of people that are so daunted by what we see in foodie culture, I'll use that term, that they don't even want to take the plunge. And that seems to be right. That kind of those meals in a box thing seems to kind of be this response to that market driven aspect of this. And to me, it's just a head scratcher, but I know everybody's different and everybody has different constraints.
And there's another piece to that too. It's not just a one way street, right? You're not just watching this media and getting input that way. You've got probably foodie friends, right? And so I even mentioned to Mark on the show, I said, you know, it's like, there was a time when I would be embarrassed to be at the grocery store and one of my quote unquote foodie friends would, you know, if they walked in and looked at my card, I'd be like, oh my God, I got to start hiding things because I don't want them to know I have a can of Chef Boyardee ravioli or something in my cart. Right. You know, or whatever it is, or a box of dried pasta or a bottle of salad dressing, the horror. Right. And it's just stupid. I mean, I've gotten to a point now where it's like, I don't, you know, I can make a vinaigrette or I can go get some Hidden Valley Ranch in a bottle. I don't really care. Yeah. I mean, whatever you like is really what you need to try to get to, whatever works for you. And, you know, just kind of put these ideals to the side. They're fun. Like I said, there's Instagram pages that you could spend hours on just looking at the food and getting inspired and loving it. But, you know, I turn that off and I go cook.
Right. There you go. That's the thing, isn't it? Well, how about this? Roger, let's take a little break here on the program, and we're going to come back and chat a little bit further about the Kitchen Counter Podcast, your terrific show, and we'll get into some other topics connected to cooking at home, friends. We're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Come on back.
Frenchman right back again with that fine little number that'll
hey, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Happy to have you here on the NOLA Drink Show, friends. We are chatting with Roger Anderson, who is the host of the terrific Kitchen Counter Podcast that is geared towards home cooks and making cooking, I think, more accessible, more fun. And I really appreciate what you were saying before, too, Roger, in the previous segment, that you don't have a particular agenda. It's just about bringing information to people. And I've listened to several of your shows, as I mentioned, like, and actually one of my favorite ones that I listened to recently, because we talked about you joining the Nitty Grits podcast network, Nitty Grits podcast, I should say now, technically. And, you know, so it's like your most recent 10 shows or so, I think, are what are there. And you did one very recently on emulsification and used vinaigrette as a really good example. And what I really like about what you did, you say you're not a scientist, which I totally understand and appreciate, but you bring that kind of information. Like, you talk about, here's the technique, here's how to do something, and then here's why it works. And that really clicks with me because I'm a why guy. So if I don't understand the why, I can't just memorize a formula. So I'm terrible at baking. But I think that's your approach, right? Is that you want to give the people the why behind it so that people can apply a technique to what's going on.
I mean, I try, but, you know, there are certainly food personalities out there that are way better than I am at doing that. You know, I think of like Alton Brown as sort of the, the you know, like he's the Good Eats science guy, or not the Good Eats. It's like Good Eats. Yeah. Anyway, he was great. He is great at breaking down the why things work. You know, I try, but I have to do a lot of research on that stuff. I don't just know that. I'm not, like I said, a classically trained chef or anything. So you know, because I also hate saying things that are wrong. So I'm very paranoid when I get on the air and I record. I'm like, I cannot say something that is not true. So I'll research as much as I can to put it on there. But, you know, in different people, you like the how things work. Some people don't care. They just say, like, tell me how to make it. And I can make it 1,000 times if I just know the general recipe. So, you know, we try to hit all of those flavors.
That's kind of where I wanted to go with this. I think that's really interesting because I do think people are kind of that way, right? Where I was terrible at algebra because you were just told to memorize a formula and then use it. And I could not do that because if I didn't understand the why, I could never memorize it. It would never stick. But I was good at geometry because I could see it in my head. And so it kind of made sense. And that's how I personally, and this isn't about me, but how I like to cook is I'm a technique person over a recipe person. And so it's sort of, here's what I'm trying to accomplish. Here's what I have in the pantry. I'll go look at 6 recipes for a particular dish and then synthesize. But I realize that doesn't work for everybody. Where do you fall on that? Just personally, when you get in the kitchen?
Well, I mean, I skew more recipe guy until I understand how a dish works. Like, one of my favorite things to make is risotto, or risotto, depending on how you like to pronounce it, which is an Italian rice dish, creamy textured rice dish. And, you know, I followed a recipe for many years until now I can make it in my sleep. I don't have to use a recipe. And because I'm familiar, I always tell people, like, if you want to get good at improvising, you need to deep dive into a few things, get really, really comfortable with them. And then you can start improvising in ways where you're not like, what happens if I take the saffron out of that recipe? Well, when you make it 40 times, you'll know, and you can do that. But I get a lot of people that come to me and say, I want to improvise. I don't want to follow recipes. Well, you know, we were talking about musical instruments earlier. It's just like music, right? You can't pick up a guitar and improvise until you understand really how a guitar works and how you play chords and picking patterns and things like that. So you just have to get relatively good at some cooking before you can really be a good improviser. And again, chefs are great improvisers and they have a lot of years and a lot of like battle tested knowledge, right? Home cooks, we don't. So it's less important, I think, to be a great improviser on the fly. as a home cook. Now, improvising might mean something else. If you open your fridge and say, like, I've got some asparagus, I've got some eggs, some cheese. Cheese, what could I make with that? That's different than I'm whipping up, a stir fry. What flavors would go good in the heat of the moment? Does that make sense? So improvise on the fly. You can also improvise when you're planning ahead. Right. Based on what you've got available or what's in season.
Okay.
You always watch these food TV shows where the guy goes to the market and he's like, oh, rutabagas are in season. I know exactly what I'm going to make with a rutabaga. That's probably not in the skill set of most home cooks, right? They need to know it, that they have it, and research it a bit.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Let's start with what the hell is a rutabaga, and then what do I do with a rutabaga?
No, let's not go there. I'm not a rutabaga guy. It's just the funniest sounding vegetable I can think of at the moment.
It is, exactly. So we were talking about this just briefly during the previous break, and we were talking about cooking shows in the previous segment about this sort of, celebrity chef, cult of personality thing, the very image driven. You were talking about that with Mark Bittman about, sort of either it's competition or makes you feel inferior. One of your recent guests actually is on a show on the Cooking Channel. That's one of my wife's favorite shows, Jeff Morrow from The Kitchen. And mm-hmm. I really like that show because that show kind of takes the approach that we're sort of talking about here, that it's not trying to make things that are way above and beyond. Sure, they're pretty. You have, various different levels of chefs. I just think that to me, that's the type of cooking show that I really enjoy watching because I learn something. I don't need to watch people beat up on each other and tell people how bad they suck and things like that. I mean, I want to learn something. Go ahead, please.
I agree. And Jeff was amazing. And if you listen to the episode, I mean, he's a hilarious guy, funnier than I was even expecting in person. But
he was a comedian, right? Before he started doing, I think, right? Wasn't he a stand up?
I think he still is.
Okay.
I think he still does that to some degree. And he's a musician as well.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay. So he's multi talented. And you're right. The show, The Kitchen, is, and I think it works because they're not like talking down or pandering or, I mean, like Iron Chef, you know what you're getting with that show, right? Like nobody in a home kitchen is going to make what they're making in Iron Chef. And you watch Iron Chef partly for like the takedowns, right? Like it didn't work. Right. You know, The Kitchen is different. They're not doing that. And they're actually giving you some practical, usable things. So, so not all food TV is bad, but in fact, I would say a lot of it's good. It's just how you take it in and absorb it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, did you get aside from your mom and then growing up around food and cooking for your family, did you get inspiration from somewhere else? Like, did you start watching cooking shows and some things like that?
Oh, sure. You know who, one of my big inspirations and near and dear to New Orleans, of course, is Paul Prudhomme, right?
Oh, sure, yep.
I mean, I loved his show. And he was kind of down to earth. I mean, he was quirky and fun to watch, but I felt like he would speak my language. Because I remember there was one of this great quote that he did on one of his shows where he's like, if you want to make people start salivating, right, you just take a kettle of water, throw a couple of cloves of garlic in there, a little bit of onion, and like simmer it on low, and like people will be running to the kitchen. I'm like, that's true, man. And just kind of that really rustic, love-infused approach, that inspires me. You know, Iron Chef inspires me too, but it's just because, I'm watching some guy, debone a chicken in like 13 seconds, and I'll never do that, and I never need to do that, but those are inspiring. They're aspirational.
There you go.
And even if I don't cook what they're turning out, oftentimes I'll see an ingredient where I'm like, what is that? I should learn more about that. And, that's a useful way to use that kind of media, I think.
I think that's really well said. I think that there's entertainment value, right? And there's maybe wonder value, and then there's practical value. And I think we find with a lot of the cooking shows that are on TV these days, I mean, they've gone so far, it's like MTV, right? MTV used to play music videos. So, it's the same kind of thing. Cooking shows used to play cooking shows. Now it's a lot of competition and stuff like that. Well, let's do this, Roger. Let's go ahead and take a little break here, and then we're going to come back and talk a little bit more with you about the show and some other ideas behind home cooking. And you're going to stick around for another Shot with Nola Drinks. Our podcast only segment's going to come up shortly, too. So friends, what we're going to take a little break here on the Nola Drink Show. Come on back. Sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, I'm going to set your flag on fire. You're talking about hey now, hey now, hey now. Aiko, aiko, ande. Giacomo Fino, anane. Giacomo Finane. Hey everybody, Roger here. Check out the kitchen counter for a smorgasbord of home cooking tips and inspiration. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts or at kitchencounterpodcast.com.
Ah!
All right, everyone, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here at WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Happy to have you here, friends, on the NOLA Drink Show. As always, we are chatting with Roger Anderson, who is the host of the Kitchen Counter podcast, a very fine podcast that is also on the Nitty Grits podcast, which is the podcast network of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Go to southernfood.org. Check it out right at the top of the website. You will find Roger's show and four or five other really good shows. And then this show. We're kind of the one that's bringing everybody down. So we're glad to have you on the network, Roger, because you buoyed the network back up. You're kind of compensating for me, which is fantastic.
Oh, please.
But it's really great to have you on, and great to have you on the network, as we were talking about before. Let me ask you this question. And been sort of trailing away at times from talking about the pandemic and so on and so forth and how it affects things, but obviously it's put a serious imprint on all of us. You started doing your show, obviously, well before the pandemic. How have you seen, with your, like, say, your audience and even your own experiences, how does the pandemic, how did it change, or did it change people's approach to home cooking? I think it's kind of an obvious question,
I think it did change people's approach to home cooking. I mean, look, we all remember, if we're even remotely connected with food, social media, right? The sourdough craze of 2020, right? Like, everybody was trying to figure out how to make sourdough bread, which is great. It's awesome. And I think more people should know how to make sourdough bread or experiment with it. And I think more people, you know, there were fewer options, certainly where I lived. Like, we couldn't even go get takeout for a period of time if we wanted to. So we were either you've got to microwave something up, throw a pizza in the oven, or figure out how to cook. And by the way, I would consider those other things cooking too, just different degrees of that, right? So I think people did, for the fortunate ones that could get in the kitchen and cook a little bit more, I think people did. Now, I've read some market research, and I couldn't give you the source off the top of my head, but where, you know, people say they're going to continue cooking after the pandemic and after restaurants open up. And I'm a little skeptical of that. I don't know. I feel like it's like, oh, I've got a ride to work because there's no bus that goes where I go. So I'm great. I love bike riding. And then a bus line opens up and you're like, screw the bike, get on the bus. Right. So in a way I feel maybe some folks are going to have that sort of an experience with home cooking, because, you know, in a pandemic, this is not an ordinary time, right? It was not an ordinary time. Cooking was different. Getting ingredients was tough. Like, if you may have been on the sourdough craze train, but you may not have been able to get flour for a month.
Bread flour was something. Longer. Bread flour was seriously something. Yeah.
Yes. Or if you were a yeast baker, you know, yeast was impossible to find. Mm-hmm. Right. So, the short answer, yes, it certainly did change people's attitude and experience with home cooking. I don't know how long lasting those changes are, but I'm grateful for any opportunity that forces people to reexamine how they feed themselves.
Right.
With their own hands. Yeah,
absolutely. Which is such an important part of this, I think. And part of as we're talking about the joy of home cooking is doing something for yourself. And, I've had a couple conversations on the show and also with just people in the industry and other things. And I'm finding a lot of it, this is all anecdotal, but a lot of people talking about how, they'll go back to restaurants, go back to bars, all these sorts of things, but more selective in as to why or when and how. And not, because I think, as we know, like you were talking about, we can never produce something that you're going to see on Iron Chef, but if you're a decent home cook or a decent home bartender, you can probably hit 85-90% level of something that's really good. And it's that 10%, am I paying a premium for that? Where we're really paying a premium, at least in my opinion, Roger, is that it's the experience of going out, being with people, the environment, the ambiance, so on and so forth. And that's what we're paying for. And to me, when you start to kind of think about it that way, then I don't just want to trivialize it or have it be just repetitive or trite. That's why I'm going out. So I want all of that comes with it if I'm going to go drop $150 for a meal for two and a bottle of wine.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And make no mistake, I want to state clearly that there are a lot of home cooks, most of whom are way more proficient than I am, that turn out some really amazing looking food and tasting food. So I don't want to paint the picture like home cooks, it's impossible for home cooks to turn out restaurant quality food. A lot of them do. Mm-hmm. But you're right. I think, and the experience, like my wife and I here in Oregon, the pandemic restrictions have slowly been easing as people get vaccinated. And it's like, we went out to eat without our son, 'cause he was at a friend's house. We went out to eat out in a restaurant for the first time in like a year. You know, not counting takeout. And I felt like a human being again, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you can only see your family so much. I hate to say that, but you can only fire up your stove so many times. And before it's like, I just feel like I'm living in a cave. This is just not right. You know, we're social creatures. So I 100% agree with you. And I cannot wait to get back out and have drinks and hang out with friends and go, you know, go sit down at restaurants and eat in a somewhat normal atmosphere. So yeah, I agree with you. I think paying that premium is what that's all about for that.
Yeah, it was very, very striking to me to go through that experience. And I, you know, the other thing too, and don't want to talk too much about this, but I, you know, started to have this realization that, and don't get me wrong, because I love going out and supporting our service industry is amazingly important. But there was also, I could just mention that number, $150 for a meal for two and maybe a bottle of wine somewhere at a decent, you know, fast casual kind of place or something. You know, for $150, I can buy myself some pretty cool kitchen stuff. And, you know, we started moving my wife and I were very fortunate through the pandemic economically to continue working. And, you know, it was like, well, we can't go spend it at a restaurant. So, you know, I bought myself a sous vide, man.
That's cool. That is cool.
It was great.
And, that's a big trend, you know, or at least it was, you know, in the recent past, but yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, $150 can buy a heck of a lot of food.
And a heck of a lot of
for home cooked meals. So, I mean, yeah, you can divert that, but I think it's important. You're right. The service industry is obviously they're hurting here in Oregon, certainly. And we're just now looking at, thankfully, really relaxation of some restrictions. I hope it doesn't come back to haunt us, but it's a delicate balancing act. But anyway, I'm just my way of saying I agree with your sentiments 100%. And I think a lot of people did invest in tools and things like that for their kitchen during the pandemic. I know I did because I wasn't spending money other ways.
But what was your favorite kitchen gadget or such that you bought during the pandemic?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. So I upgraded. I had a dinky, junky little air fryer. So I upgraded to one where I could like cook a family's worth of food in there. And that's a fun, I mean, an air fryer is a misnomer. It's just a convection oven. That's all it is. It's just a small convection oven that's really freaking hot and really pushes the air around. So you can get similar results in your convection oven, you know, your large range oven at home, but those air fryers, they really do a good job of really blasting the heat. So you get that, you know, fried approximation. So I got an air fryer. Gosh, I'm drawing a blank now. I've got this is embarrassing, but I have a whole rack in my garage of kitchen. I could probably cater or rent it out, but it's like I've got home versions of most every restaurant item you can imagine. I do have a deep fat fryer, which other than it's a pain to get rid of the used oil when it's spent, I love using. That's a lot of fun because there's things you can do in like a little console deep fat fryer you can't do in your Dutch oven, yes, right? Or your saucepan.
Yes.
So that's fun.
Yes. That's similarly, when we take a break, I'll checklist more of our stuff with you, but we bought a 5-liter Cuisinart, almost industrial level deep fryer. And that made the mistake of using it inside once, Roger, the first time. It gets used on the back porch on a TV tray now. I learned that one.
I'll tell you what I did get, and this was just prior to the pandemic. My wife, for Father's Day / birthday gift, she got me a Kamado grill. And so a Kamado grill is like the big green egg. We have a Kamado Joe, but it's like those round egg-shaped ceramic cookers. I have to tell you, that has transformed my outdoor cooking life.
Really?
It's amazing. They're not cheap for a good quality one, but I have to tell you, I will never probably grill or barbecue on anything because you can grill and you can barbecue in those purest sense of the terms in that thing. And the food is amazing. So I don't know why I went there, but just
you're making me jealous because I've had my eye on one. Like there's a little bit of a budgetary consideration with those.
Oh, things, they're nuts. But I'll tell you what, they're amazing. I mean, you can cook low and slow. You can keep it at 220 or 250 for 10 hours, or you can crank that thing up to 900 degrees and sear a steak on it. I mean, it's crazy. Or cook a pizza. They're really cool.
Yeah,
they're really cool.
That's so awesome. Yeah. Well, how about this? We got about a minute left before I have to close out the portion of the radio show. You're sticking around for another shot with Nola Drinks, our podcast only segment. But for our radio listeners, Roger, would you please tell people where they can connect with you and your wonderful podcast, The Kitchen Encounter?
Well, you can find the podcast pretty much anywhere you can find podcasts, like Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Amazon Music or whatever. But kitchencounterpodcast.com is my website. And that's probably the easiest one to remember. If you just hop over there, you can listen to the show right there on the website, or there'll be links to all the different, you know, podcast players. You can also find me on Twitter at TKC Podcast. And then we have a Facebook page and a group, but the page is over at facebook.com/KitchenCounterPodcast.
Very good. It's an excellent show, friends. I really encourage you to go check out what Roger does, especially if you are a home cook or just even interested in taking the plunge into being a home cook. I would recommend it as a great place to start because it doesn't pander, but it doesn't just talk right over your head either. And I've listened, as I said, to several episodes recently, Roger, and I've gotten something out of every single one of them. Fantastic.
Appreciate that. I appreciate that. This has been a wonderful conversation, so thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Friends, if you're listening on the radio, remember to be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until next time, cheers, y'all. Everybody, hey, thanks for sticking around for another Shot with Nola Drinks. I hope you are enjoying this conversation with Roger from the Kitchen Counter Podcast. A lot of fun talking to him, and that's what we're going to do right now. Bounce right back over to that conversation. Here we go. Yep, another Shot with Nola Drinks. Friends, we're chatting with Roger Anderson, who is the host of the Kitchen Counter Podcast, one of the many great shows. I should say many. We're at five, Roger, on the Nitty Grits Podcast, the podcast network of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. And we got a new one coming up here, and I should know the name, but we'll announce that very soon. We seem to be adding about one a month or so. And it's really, you know, I don't have the name. I feel terrible. But it was a really interesting show. This woman does a show on cooking for like conventions and events. And when Liz Williams, who you know has been a guest on your show recently and the founder of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum and the co-executive producer, as I mentioned, of the Nitty Grits podcast along with me, she ran the show by me a couple weeks ago. And she's like, check it out. It's on cooking for events and conventions and that sort of thing. And I'm like, wow, that's niche. And so then I went and checked out the show and it's like really cool. It was talking about all kinds of stuff that you maybe wouldn't think about. This whole idea that, you know, you're so used to if you go to like a wedding or something at a hotel and it's like chicken or fish. And then what if you get somebody who's a vegan? And like a lot of what she was talking about was cooking for large groups, or there may be dietary considerations. There may be religious considerations. There may be actually inclusivity considerations for what people can eat or won't and won't eat and so on and so forth, and representation for who's coming to this event. And, you know, talking a lot about how, you know, cooking for a group, you're so much better off trying to anticipate doing these things up front than if you're cooking, you know, if you're churning out 50 plates of fish and 50 plates of chicken, and then you got to figure out on the fly, like we were talking about improvising earlier, what can I cook for the one person out there that's a vegan? Have a vegan option planned. And I think that's, it sounds like it was a really interesting show, and I think we're going to be really happy about adding that one to the network. But it brings me to a question too, because like you and I were talking during the break, and I won't ask you to repeat everything that you said, but we were talking about let's be honest with certain things, right? And so we're talking about like meat substitutes and vegan chocolate chip cookies and just stuff like that. We're talking about cauliflower crust. That'll be a story for another time. If you take them for what they are, they can be really good. Just don't lie to us and tell us that you won't know the difference between a meat substitute. So, I mean, tell briefly tell people what you just said, and then I'm going to ask you a question about cooking on a variety of levels for different diets and stuff.
Listen, I am not anti anything when it comes to food, unless obviously it's harmful to people or whatever. But so I'm not anti-vegan. I'm not anti-gluten-free. I get that there's people that choose that lifestyle, and I get that there's people that have to have that lifestyle. But I think that story I said, it's like, you'll have somebody that'll come to you and they'll be like, hey, try this chocolate chip cookie. It's gluten-free, it's vegan, and you'll never be able to tell that it's those things. It'll taste just like a chocolate chip cookie. And it's like, no, it won't. I already know it won't. And that's fine. But don't lie to me and tell me that you can't tell the difference. And, I'm not talking about like your friends, like that's whatever, but it's like, you get these food blogs and it's like, I fooled my husband into thinking this Beyond Burger was a real hamburger. And it's like, he probably didn't, he probably knew, and he's just being a good husband and he's going along with it. But, don't lie. I mean, just it's not meat, and that's okay. And I'm down with that. Does that make sense? I don't want to sound like I'm against certain types of diets or cooking, but it's like it's like there's this thing, and this happened with the meat substitutes early on, right? And it probably still does, where it's like now you can go get Beyond Meat. It's like a brick of ground beef, and it's like just whatever you want to make it. But at the beginning, it was like, here's a hot dog. It's not really a hot dog. It's like soy, but it's made to look and smell and cook and the texture or try to of a hot dog. And there's this interesting thing where it's like, we need to try to approximate, I guess it's trying to cater to people that wouldn't ordinarily go meat free. Right. And they want to be like, you can still have your hot dog and eat it too. It's just not meat. And it's this weird idea. Do you know what I mean? It's like a weird idea that we have to pretend that something is what it isn't in order for people to enjoy it.
They're two different things. Right. And I think you and I were talking during the break about, it's take it as two different things. And then you can approach using these ingredients and make them the best that they can be. And oftentimes that can be really, really good. My wife actually got some stuff. She went to a vegan restaurant and they had a bacon bits substitute. And I forget what the name of it is, but it actually is from coconut. And I tasted it, and I was like, okay, it tastes a little bit like bacon. It's got a smoky flavor, I guess, but it's like really good. And I'm like, I'm not going to pretend this is bacon. I'm not making a BLT out of it if I want an actual BLT, but like sprinkling it on some salads, and especially like a bright kind of tropical kind of salad going on with a nice bright vinaigrette or something with the coconut note in it, it's really good. So I'm like, that's what it is to me. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's actually quite delicious. It's just not, don't tell me it's fat from a pig.
it's just a funny thing. I just find it fascinating. And again, this is probably my bias with the whole food media and food blogs and things like that. Because there's a whole cottage industry of food blogs that are like, I will teach you how to eat however way. And then they're not going to go on there and say like, it doesn't taste anything like bacon, but here's a recipe. I mean, that's not their shtick, right? They're going to be like, you'll never know the difference. It's like P.T. Barnum, or not P.T. Barnum, but I shouldn't equate these people with snake oil people because they're not. But I mean, it's like this idea of like, you just got to pitch it. You got to sell it. And it's like, and then people are disappointed when they make it. And they're like, this isn't good. Like we had the cauliflower crust pizza conversation at the break. And you had a story. My sister, she had a birthday. And she said, what do you want? I'll make anything you want. She goes, well, I really want to try a cauliflower crust pizza. And I'm like, well, I'll try to make one. It was terrible. And it was, and maybe that was because I don't know how to work with cauliflower to make it into a crust, but it was terrible. I mean, I said whatever else it wasn't a pizza. It didn't taste bad, the toppings, but I mean, you couldn't pick it up. It fell apart. So I'm sure that's my failing, but I mean, it's not a pizza.
Right. But let's just be honest. So, it's pizza toppings on a cauliflower crust, and that's okay.
Yes.
I guess that's the point, that this can be okay. Well,
I was talking with my brother. It reminds me, remember back in the day in the cola wars back in the 80s and stuff, where it'd be like, I chuckle about this. It's like, he blindfold this person and put a glass of Pepsi and a glass of Coke in front of them. These people are Pepsi lovers, by the way, right? That's the shtick. And then they taste it and they're like, oh my God, I like cup B better. It's Coke. Shut up.
Come on.
Nobody would make that mistake, right? I mean, it's so marketing. It just drives me nuts. It's like, there's nobody in the world who likes one of those soft drinks that would like the other one because they couldn't tell the difference.
Right. Everybody at the mall. You could fool everybody at the mall with that.
Right. I'm ranting now, but anyway.
It's a great point. I mean, it's always interesting. I just like taking things for sort of what they are. Well, hey, I wanted to ask you, Roger, just on on kind of a specific thing. I mentioned the episode that you did recently, going back about maybe four or five episodes or so, three, on emulsification. And you're talking about, you use vinaigrette as a kind of a very common emulsified condiment dressing, whatever that you're using for marinade even. And I thought it was so well done because you kind of used it to teach about emulsification and people know what a vinaigrette is. And we were talking earlier about how you kind of bring some, you know, the why with a little bit of the science, nothing complex, in how it works. And where it's just, and I would encourage people to go check it out because you explain how emulsification works, how the ingredients work together, how you have, oh my goodness, what's the ingredient called? That's sort of the bridge, like mustard, that holds
like
things together.
Stabilizer. Or an emulsifier. Yeah.
An emulsifier. That's it. Like, of course, we're talking about emulsification. So the emulsifier. And it's just such a great explanation because it kind of, I think it's a great way to tell people, you know, you can have this and you can have this, your sort of, you know, water and oil ingredient. And then here's how you can bridge this stuff. And I didn't know, for example, that gas was gasoline was an emulsified thing. It's all around the world. So, all around us, all around our world. So it's really interesting how you brought that to the fore. And I mean, I came away with some ideas for technique, which I think is fantastic. But where I'm going with this, I'm sorry, I just want to tee that episode up because I think I want to encourage people to go listen to it. But then you were talking about how you're going to be working on doing an episode on marinades specifically. And I know you've said you've been kind of thinking about it and working on it for a while. So maybe I'll ask you like kind of, what would be sort of the difference between, say, like using a vinaigrette, which is a great, obviously you can use it as a quote unquote marinade on chicken, for example, the difference there. And then what you teed up that I am very, very curious to know about, and I'm just going to put a little pressure on you here, the jerk chicken marinade that you've been working on.
Well,
you set it up, man. So I had to bring it up.
I cannot take credit for the jerk chicken marinade totally because I started with a recipe I have in a cookbook. And in fact, it's right behind me. Let me just see if I can see the name of it because I'm terrible. I have a terrible memory.
I'm with you on that one.
Shoot, I don't have it, but it's by the Mackinuff brothers. Real Flavor, True Flavor.
Okay.
Yeah, they're from the Caribbean and they've gone back. And anyway, so I started with their jerk chicken marinade recipe and it's freaking great. I mean, I could eat it like a soup. It's so good.
Wow.
Like many marinades are. I mean, that's the point of a marinade is to deliver really big, bold flavor. I can give you the details on that, but I think you had what was your first question? It was more
emulsified stuff versus a marinade. I mean, because you can use a vinaigrette makes for a wonderful quote unquote marinade, but there's obviously a difference because of what we're talking about. I guess it's the nature of the ingredients.
Well, actually not really, because I think it's just the nature of how those ingredients are prepared. So in a vinaigrette, you've emulsified the oil in a vinaigrette's case, an acid like vinegar or maybe lemon juice, and you've made them play nicely together. Maybe you've added some mustard, so they're emulsified and they stay together, and those work perfectly fine as a marinade. I mean, a marinade really is also acid and oil and flavoring components and probably salt if you've not already brined whatever it is you're marinating. So I mean, as far as what they're comprised of, they're quite similar, and that's why vinaigrettes work so well as a marinade. But a marinade, you really have to have. And there's a lot of misconceptions, I think, about marinades. Like a lot of folks will say, like the acid in a marinade is there to tenderize the meat. Well, it does to a degree. It can tenderize the surface of that meat. But marinades work on a very superficial level. Like if you throw a pork shoulder, like a Boston butt, in a bag with a marinade, it's only going to marinate the surface and a little bit beyond. You're not certainly going to tenderize that whole cut of meat, right? Because it just can't get in there. to do that.
Right.
But if you're marinating a flank steak, which is very thin, that's a different, it's working on a superficial level, but there's a lot more surface to like mass. Does that make sense? So marinating in a way where you don't have all this internal muscle that's like not getting any of the benefit of that marinade.
Right.
As opposed to a thinner steak. So really that's a long-winded answer, but the short answer is a vinaigrette and a marinade are very similar. But not all marinades are that.
I mean,
you can make a marinade out of anything, but you have to have fat. You have to have maybe a little acid for flavor, I think, and the other flavorings, but you have to have fat. That's probably the most important ingredient in a marinade because it's, you know, a lot of the flavorings you put in a marinade are fat soluble flavor compounds. So if you were to marinate, let's say you take that flank steak and you throw it in a bag with some water and some salt and, a bunch of herbs, you're not going to get the flavor from those herbs that you get if you used oil instead of water, right? That's why you use oil in a marinade because it can break down those fat soluble flavor compounds.
Okay, great. That's great. And we were talking about not lying to people too. And I've always wondered, And you raised a really good point. When you, excuse me, if you're going to marinate something, no matter how long you marinate for, if it's a big thick piece of meat, it's only going to penetrate so far. But I always used to scratch my head when people would advertise the 30-minute marinade stuff, because I mean, to me, that's almost more like a sauce than it is a marinade. Yeah. Because what's it can, even on the surface, what's it going to really flavor? Unless maybe you're going to immediately throw it on the grill and it's going to form part of the crust.
Well, you know, the thing about jerk chicken too, which is interesting, and you can do this with a lot of your meat, you know, jerk, a lot of the sources say part of that word is from this action of juking or poking. It could be pork, it could be beef, it could be whatever, but the meat to allow the marinade, like with a stick or with a fork to allow the marinade
to penetrate,
or you can score it with a knife. You know, you're increasing the surface area for that marinade to attach to and work its flavor magic. But, you know, you bring up a good point too. Marinades are awesome because they can do three things. They're a marinade. If you're grilling, or even if you're roasting in the oven, you can use them as a basting sauce. And you can also use them as a finishing sauce. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can use that same marinade recipe and do all three of those things with one meal. And, you know, so if you just marinate with your jerk chicken, it might not have that the flavor at the end that just blows your mind. But if you're basting with it and use it as a sauce at the end, then it would, you know, bring more flavor. But, you know, if you're going to marinate and you're going to use that same marinade, that's okay. You just have to boil it. You have to cook it first because it's obviously coming in contact with raw food. My recommendation would just be make extra and set some aside.
Okay.
You know, for the sauce at the end. So you don't have to worry about the food safety concerns.
That's great. That's really good. We actually do that a lot at home, Roger, where we'll take, you know, take leftover marinade, even if it's touched the raw meat. Sometimes, you know, like you said, it maybe doesn't have the exact flavor you want, but you can always doctor it up and then put it in the pot and simmer it, you know, and then take care of it. And then there's your dipping sauce or side sauce for.
Yeah. As long as you're cooking it, you know, you're being safe with that, but certainly don't take a marinade and use it as a finishing sauce. You know, if you've just made jerk chicken and you've not cooked it, that would be bad.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you, cause I was mentioning that show about cooking for events. And, do you find when you're cooking, say at home, or if you're cooking, I mean, I know with the pandemic, it's been somewhat difficult, but cooking for a group of people, do you like to dabble in cooking like vegan and vegetarian? Do you try and do like a vegetable dish one night a week? I know you're a big proponent of vegetables and Bronnie, you asked the questions about how to, you know, broaden your use of vegetables in your cooking approach.
You know, so my food consumption history is basically Midwestern style, right? So I'm a real meat and potatoes guy. And that has put me at somewhat of a disadvantage, I think, mentally throughout my life for, you know, trying like really vegetable centric foods. I love vegetables, but it is a challenge for me. And I think it's a challenge for a lot of people to figure out, you know, it's not something you can do casually, I find, for most people, to make vegetables sort of the star or make meat-free dishes. So you have to go about it very conscientiously, very intentionally, I should say. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I do dabble with that, but I'm not that good at it. I'm just not that good at it. And it's very, part of it is, you know, being constrained by however you think a certain vegetable should be cooked, because you've had it that way forever, right? You know, I'm constantly amazed when you go to a restaurant and if you do get something that's vegetarian or vegan, it's like, I didn't know you could do that. I mean, I never thought you could put these ingredients together in a way that just didn't taste like asparagus, beans, and, you know, kale or something like that. Mm-hmm. So for a home cook, for me in particular, it's just hard. You really have to work at it intentionally. And part of that is, you know, going to blogs that are vegetarian centric, getting cookbooks that are vegetarian centric. And in fact, I have a couple cookbooks that are geared towards, and this doesn't fall into the umbrella of don't lie to me, but there are some books that are geared towards people that like to eat meat. And these are meatless recipes for those people, because it's not just about being fooled, but it's about, you know, people eat meat because maybe they like the texture. Maybe they like the way the tastes, you know, there could be cultural reasons. There could be religious reasons why people choose to eat meat or whatever. But these, you know, these recipes are like, you know, my favorite is like the portobello mushroom hack, right? I mean, that's a very meaty thing. Mm-hmm. Tastes like meat in many ways. And you're never going to fool anybody if you throw a grilled portobello on a bun. They're not going to say this is an amazing
Don't lie to me.
Don't lie to me. But, you know, those sorts of things where it's like, it's very easy to take something like a grilled or a cooked up portobello mushroom and, you know, cook that into a lasagna without sausage or something like that. So, I mean, you know, there's ways you can experiment with comfortable or things that you know how to cook, but you just take the meat out and put other things in. That's an easy one. That's one I always go to.
That's great. You know, I find myself attracted to I growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area, as I mentioned to you, and I was lucky enough to be exposed to a lot of a wide variety of ethnic foods because of the representation of different populations that, you know, that are there. And, you know, cooking like Indian cooking or Southeast Asian cooking, Thai, for example, or Indonesian, things like that. I love that food, and those are my favorite vegetarian dishes because they're just, the flavor is there, and is to borrow your word, they're made intentionally without meat, so they're not trying to fool you in any way, shape, or form. That's the way these dishes are supposed to be, and the flavors are so vibrant and so fresh, and you're getting, you know, acid, and you're getting all this stuff in the meals, and I mean, that, for me personally, that's what I kind of prefer because I feel like I'm getting something that tastes so good, and it's supposed to taste that way.
You know what? I think for a lot of people in the United States, and I'll make a gross generalization here, but I think for a lot of people who have problems with vegetables, I would be willing to bet money that a lot of it boils down to when they were growing up, the vegetables were always boiled or, you know, made to be mushy and gross. And yeah, I wouldn't eat Brussels sprouts either if every Brussels sprout I ever ate in my life was boiled to like a pulpy mass of cabbage like stuff. Right. I mean, I get that. And like, why would you as an adult say like, oh, I will give Brussels sprouts another try. No, you're not. Cause you know what you think they taste like. So getting out of those modes of thinking where it's like, oh, I know, you know, like my mom's favorite way to make carrots. My mom was a great cook, but her favorite way to make carrots was to cook them until she could mash them and just eat them like mashed carrots with some salt on it. And I'm like, I didn't like carrots for a long time. You know, it's like but you know, I get it now, like roasting carrots, like a nice little, like, you know, the little carrots with the top still on it. I mean, that's like, there's nothing better than that if they're fresh, local and in season, if you can do it. But you know, you just kind of have to, yeah, you just got to figure out different ways to approach those things. Oh, raw vegetables. Most vegetables you can eat raw. Why even mess with them if you can just chop them up and throw them in a bowl and dress them with a vinaigrette perhaps or something. But you know, people should try that. They might be surprised. Some vegetables you probably should cook, but most you can eat raw. And even if that show with Mark Bittman, I mean, even like my mom would eat potatoes raw, which I just thought was the most crazy thing I've ever seen. But she'd stand by the pot and she'd peel the potato, and then she'd come over and, you know, she wouldn't use a cutting board ever. She just used her hand and her thumb and the knife and would cut off chunks of the potato. And like every last chunk of potato she'd eat. And then she'd get the next potato and do it. So you can eat lots of vegetables raw and it's not going to hurt you. And in fact, you might find a whole new appreciation for, you know, those vegetables that you've got laying around.
That's a great
that
point.
You always boiled That's or whatever. Boiled, or grilling. You know, we talked about grilling on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, grilling throw some asparagus on the grill. Toss it with a little olive oil, salt, and grill them. Get them all charred. And a few minutes is all you need. And they're like a whole new thing.
Absolutely. Man, all good information and good points. Well, do me a favor, Roger. Tell people before we close out our podcast only segment here where they can connect with you and the Kitchen Counter podcast.
Yeah, sure. Well, the podcast is pretty much everywhere you can find podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever podcast app you use. KitchenCounterPodcast.com is my website. Everything's there as well. You can listen to the episodes right from the website. My Twitter is TKC Podcast. Or at TKC Podcast, and then Facebook, facebook.com/KitchenCounterPodcast. So those are the main ways to find the show, to find me. I'm usually lurking on those social media sites, and I always try to respond to anybody that reaches out to me. So if listeners have a question, they just want to say hi, I love that stuff. So please, you know, reach out to me and
awesome.
We'll chat.
Awesome. That's great. It's a great show, friends. Go check out the Kitchen Counter podcast, and you can also get it. Just go to southernfood.org, and right there at the top, you'll see podcasts and blog right there, one of the links in the main navigation bar. Click on podcasts, and you'll see Roger's terrific show there as well. Roger, hopefully we'll see you down here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans soon. And as I mentioned to you during the break, my mom lives in Oregon, so when I get out there for a visit, I know Brookings is about, that's a good 5 or 6 hours, I think.
It's a big state. Yeah. It's a big state. Yeah. Brookings is a bit of a haul, but yeah, you come up and, you know, we'll take you out to some good local wineries and get you fixed up.
You're speaking my language, my friend. Thank you so much, Roger, for being here. I really appreciate it.
Brian, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Friends, a brief musical interlude, and I'll be back to close things out. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. Happy to have had you here. As always, fun conversation with my friend Roger from the Kitchen Counter podcast. Be sure to check out his terrific show wherever you find your podcasts. And may I recommend the Nitty Grits Podcasts, which is the Nitty Grits Podcast Network, which is the podcast network of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I think I needed to say podcast there like three times, so I did. But if you go to southernfood.org, you will find a link right there at the top. It says blog and podcasts, and you will find Roger's show there, as well as this show and several other good ones, which reminds me of a couple upcoming programming notes. The next show we have coming out is an interview with Melanie Young and David Ransom, who host the Connected Table Live, and that's a fun show also on the Nitty Grits Network. They've been doing it for a little while. You can find them on iHeartRadio and a bunch of other places. And the Connected Table Live, as a matter of fact, I was a guest on their show, that's right, just earlier today. And we talk a little bit about New Orleans and dive bars in New Orleans and some other stuff like that. So a lot of fun. Thanks to them for having me on. And this show with them, I taped this a little while ago. They will be on coming up here pretty quick. And then after that, something I've been talking about for a while, we will have our completion of our Georgian Wines trilogy coming out pretty quick. Part three of us covering and diving in a pretty good deal of depth there, a great deal of detail, that's probably how I should say it, into the wines of Georgia, that very interesting, fascinating place, the cradle of winemaking on our planet, as I like to say. As I've talked about before, we did a first show on the wines of Georgia dating back to April of 2020. And we talked about the eastern portion of the country, a lot of the history, traditional winemaking techniques, things like that. We did a show, a few weeks ago where we talked about the western portion of the country right there on the Black Sea. And we talked a little bit more in addition to the region itself, terroir, so on. We talked a little bit more about the economics and the export market and some things like that in the world of Georgian wine. And then this show coming up, we're going to talk about the central portion of the country, and then kind of emphasize a little bit about sort of moving forward and looking into the future of the wines of Georgia, balancing tradition versus modern and all kinds of interesting stuff. Our guest on this show coming up on that program is the guy who was on the first show, Noel Brockett from Georgian Winehouse. It's a really, really interesting conversation. We just taped that one very recently, and that'll be out real quick as well. Also want to mention, too, because I had Roger on today from the Kitchen Counter podcast, if you check out his latest episode, he had me on very recently for National Rum Day. And what did we talk about? Yeah, that's right. You guessed it. Rum. And I packed a whole bunch of bottles, brought them up here to the home studio. And don't worry, I didn't drink that many. I think I had three drams. Okay, it was pretty reasonable. But we talk about styles of rum, and he's a home cook guy, obviously, because since he just heard this show, so he talks about cooking with rum and some just different thoughts about different cocktails, its history, somewhat sordid and violent history in many cases, but a really fascinating conversation. So go check that out, all about rum on the Kitchen Counter podcast, friends. We'll be back very soon with Melanie and David from the Connected Table Live next time around. That's our parting shot. Here's to you.